Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the first event for 2017 at the Lowy at the NGV calendar. I'm Louisa Fitzgerald, Chief Operating Officer at the Lowy Institute, and I'll be moderating tonight's panel discussion with three Lowy Institute experts on the big issues that will affect Australia and the world in the year ahead. I'm joined by three excellent colleagues and I'll introduce them in a moment, but first, let me recap briefly on the year that was. 2016 was a busy year for the Lowy Institute. We hosted distinguished journalists like David Ignatius of the Washington Post and Jim Fallows of the Atlantic, and international policymakers like Jean-David Levite, foreign policy advisor to three successive French presidents, and James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence in the United States. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull delivered our annual Lowy Lecture, his first major foreign policy address. And we hosted speeches by Foreign Minister Julie Bishop, Treasurer Scott Morrison, and Chief of Army Angus Campbell. In collaboration with Penguin Random House, we published two fantastic Lowy Institute papers, The Embarrassed Colonialist by Sean Dorney and Fighting with America by Professor James Curran. But outside the Institute, 2016 was a turbulent year for the world. In Europe, terrorism, migration, Brexit, and the rise of far-right political parties dominated the agenda. The Bastille Day attack in Nice that killed 86 people and the Christmas market attack in Berlin, which killed 12, capped off a violent year for Europe. We've seen the rise of populist far-right parties in Germany, France, and the Netherlands. And in Britain, of course, we saw one of the biggest global stories of 2016, Brexit. In Asia, media reports have been dominated by the dispute over the South China Sea, and in July, it appeared that China had suffered a massive blow when The Hague ruled that Beijing's nine-dash line lacked historical legitimacy. In the Philippines, we saw the election of populist President Rodrigo Duterte. In Thailand, the death of the long-reigning king. In Myanmar, the transfer of power to democracy campaigner Aung San Suu Kyi's party. And in Indonesia, terrorist attacks, rising conservatism, and a scandal involving the Jakarta governor. In the Middle East, of course, we've seen the ongoing war in Syria and Iraq and a resultant human tragedy on a massive scale. Failed peace talks and escalated fighting forced thousands of Syrians to flee their homeland, and slow progress towards the defeat of Islamic State has raised questions about what will happen next with the tens of thousands of foreign fighters who have travelled to the region. But of course, the big story towards the end of 2016 was the surprise election of President Trump in the United States. His eventual success defied most opinion polls and is considered by many to be a rejection of establishment politics. And as we go into 2017, the truth is that the United States is probably the single biggest source of geopolitical instability in the world. There's enormous uncertainty about the way this administration will govern, the way it will develop, the mistakes it will make, and its ability to correct its course. And of course, most importantly, the temperament and personality of President Trump himself. But 2017 will see important things happening right around the world, not just in the United States. 2017 will see the 19th Communist Party Congress in Beijing, elections in the Netherlands, in France, Germany, and South Korea, and closer to home in East Timor, Papua New Guinea, and New Zealand. Brexit negotiations and the associated legal challenges, and the centenaries of the Russian Revolution and the US entry into World War I. We are in for an interesting year. Let me introduce today's panel. Joining me are Dr. John Edwards, former board member of the Reserve Bank and non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute in Economics, Dr. Ewan Graham, the director of our International Security Program, and Aaron Connolly, our East Asia Research Fellow, who also happens to be a US citizen. I'm going to begin by giving each panel member a couple of minutes to tell us what they think will be the most important development in 2017. Aaron, I'm going to start with you. The world is talking about President Trump, and much has been made of the potential for US institutions to moderate President Trump and his administration. Do you think that's likely, and how do you see that struggle playing out in 2017?
Well, I remember when we were at the NGV back in November, I put an argument to some of you who I think were probably here at the time that once Donald Trump got into office, that his political advisors like Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller, who have been pushing this America First agenda and really sort of filling an empty vessel that is Donald Trump's ideology or his ideological framework with very populist nationalist ideas, that they would have to share time with members of the system, that they would have to share FaceTime with people like General Joe Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I think for a few weeks after we spoke in November at the NGV, there was reason to hope that that might be the case. Donald Trump nominated Jim Mattis, another Marine general, to be Secretary of Defense. He nominated Rex Tillerson, who, although he has no experience in foreign policy and government, ran ExxonMobil, which often acts as though it has its own foreign policy. And so there was reason to think that he might surround himself with some competent people, that they would listen to their institutions, and they would feed that back to the president, and that ultimately President Trump might moderate in office. I think at this point, after the 3 weeks that we've had so far, we have to discount that theory. And I'd say that for a few reasons. First of all, on the side of the ledger that says that institutions still matter, Jim Mattis has turned out to be a really excellent Secretary of Defense. And he has been very clear that he believes it's his duty and the United States Defense Department's duty to have America live up to its international agreements, to support the liberal international order that creates the prosperity and the security that we all enjoy. And he's even begun to influence President Trump on significant issues. So President Trump had said on the campaign trail that he was going to reintroduce torture of terror suspects. And that is something that General Mattis has convinced him not to do. So he appears to be having a positive influence on Trump in some areas. But the last 3 weeks have not been good for this theory, mostly because President Trump appears determined to go around Washington's institutions, or in some cases, to mold them to his objectives. And I think the most disturbing thing that has happened in the last few weeks, which wasn't as reported on as some of the other executive orders, was the way that President Trump reorganized his National Security Council. And it has been a longstanding norm in the United States that political advisors in the White House should not even sit in on meetings of the National Security Council. There was a firewall between people who looked at polls all day and thought about electoral strategies all day, and those people who had to think about decisions of war and peace, ordering special forces raids, you know, what the United States does with regard to China on serious issues of security like the South China Sea. That's now been broken down by President Trump, as he's appointed Steve Bannon to sit on the Principals Committee of the National Security Council. I worked for a Democratic National Security Advisor, Sandy Berger, who early in the 1990s, in the early stages of the Clinton administration, fought a battle with the political advisors in the White House to make sure they couldn't even sit in on the meetings. And that was something that President Bush, Bush 43, President George W. Bush, and also President Obama also insisted upon, that political advisors stay out of those meetings. And now you have one who is actually a member of this committee. It effectively elevates Steve Bannon, who of course ran the far-right website Breitbart, to cabinet level within the confines of the National Security Council. So not only does Trump appear to be willing to go around these institutions, as he did on the immigration executive order, which wasn't properly vetted by lawyers or by civil servants at the Department of Homeland Security, he also appears to be trying to shape those institutions in ways that would make them less effective guardians of liberal values, fundamental liberal values. So I think that the primary story of 2017, and perhaps even the next 4 years as a whole, will be the battle between these institutions and the civil servants and the military officers and the intelligence officers who staff them, who are really signed up to the defense of fundamental liberal values. When I talk to intelligence officers, they say that there's no way that we're going back to that era when there were black sites and torture. We will not defy the laws that were passed over the last few years that prohibit it. So it's going to be a battle between people like that and people in the White House who have a very different view of fundamental liberal values. And I think that'll define at least the next year, if not the next 4 years.
And moving to Southeast Asia, how do you see the reaction to the election of President Trump, and what do you think are the major developments we're likely to see in that region this year?
Southeast Asia has been moving in an illiberal direction slowly, gradually for the last 5 years at least. And, you know, we see this in places like Indonesia, where the prosecution of Jakarta's governor, Ahok, for blasphemy is a very negative sign about religious freedom in that country and the ability of religious minorities to partake in public life in Indonesia. We see it in the Philippines, where President Duterte is waging a brutal war against drugs that has really undone the rule of law in the Philippines. And we see it in other places where it's perhaps a little bit more subtle. Prime Minister Najib in Malaysia was once thought to be a liberal reformer, an internationalist reformer at the very least, that although he came from a conservative authoritarian party, he was beginning to slowly open Malaysia up politically. And since the 1MDB scandal, which has involved significant corruption by him and his family, he's really returned to a much more authoritarian model of leader. And perhaps the worst situation is in Myanmar, where the military, the Tatmadaw, over the last 4 months, since October 9th, has waged a brutal campaign against the Rohingya ethnic minority in Rakhine State in the far west of the country that has created about 100,000 displaced persons. And a UN report that was published just on Friday indicates that we think about 1,000 people have been massacred. There have also been mass rapes, things like that. And perhaps the most disturbing thing that I've seen to come out of the transition in the United States was the commander-in-chief in Myanmar had generally avoided any talk of retaking power. It seemed like a done deal that the military was getting out of politics and was not going to try to overturn the results of the 2015 election. But since Donald Trump's election, the commander-in-chief, the senior general, Min Aung Hlaing, has twice talked about the emergency rule provisions in the Constitution, which would allow the military to constitutionally but arbitrarily retake power. And so Donald Trump's election appears to be sending a signal to the region that these illiberal trends, which the United States has generally opposed, has always demarched foreign governments in Southeast Asia on, has always tried to limit and tried to sort of cap, the United States may not be playing that role anymore. And to be fair, we don't know what role the United States will play in Southeast Asia because this transition has been so slow and so many appointees are not yet in place. And we have to wait to see that, to see what sort of role the U.S. will play. But I wonder if Min Aung Hlaing doesn't look at Donald Trump and say, this is not someone who cares about democracy or human rights, given his rhetoric in his own country. And so I now have a much freer hand to do things that I wouldn't have been able to do under a Clinton presidency or under the Obama presidency. And so I would expect that illiberal trend in Southeast Asia to accelerate and to get much worse over the next 4 years, unless the U.S. is able to send a very clear message soon that part of our foreign policy hasn't changed. And regardless of what President Trump says domestically, the United States still expects Southeast Asian countries to remain basically liberal or to not move in an aggressively more illiberal direction.
Dr. Ewan Graham, I'll turn to you now. What effect do you think the election of President Trump will have on alliances and regional security in Asia this year?
Well, our relentless focus on President Trump shouldn't obscure the fact that it's not the only development in the region, and maybe we can come back to that later on. But I think it is the central question, like it or not, that we will inevitably be drawn back to time and time again in the year ahead. For the reasons that Aaron has already laid out, I think there is an unintentional chaotic element to the way that the administration is starting to put together its policy. But to my mind, there's also a clear intent to inject some deliberate uncertainty. And that's the real wild card. That's the difficulty that both adversaries and allies alike have in dealing, because the watchword for the United States has been continuity, predictability for so long. That's how it's actually sold its anchoring role as the widely acknowledged guarantor of security in the Asia Pacific. And now that it's sort of abjured self-consciously from that role, everyone is scurrying around to fill that vacuum. To my mind, the risk, although there's a lot of attention at the moment to potential for US foreign policy adventurism in the South China Sea or elsewhere in our region, and given the statements that have been made about questioning the one China policy, the phone call to Taiwan, that's new territory that's been broken. I think it's understandable why people in the region are alarmed. But I think that will die down in a way. I don't see that the direct risk of US foreign policy adventurism is really the key risk. It's the more insidious risk of this injection of uncertainty and how that plays out. And how it plays out, not just in a binary sense with US-China relations, but the region is, independent of the United States, already becoming much more multipolar. That's something we've seen as a long-term trend. The rise of India, the economic rise of Indonesia and other countries in Southeast Asia. And that, of course, just the simple mathematics of you've got those various, those variable equations, not just running along a bilateral axis of the US and China, but with all those independent players spoiling for foreign policy space, seeking reassurance, maybe feeling that there had been a potential for abandonment, all those things happening at once and overlaying each other. That's my worry, is that it's the chaos, which of course works against the science of prediction. So for folks like us, I guess that's our challenge. I think we have to be honest that only charlatans would project a full clairvoyance on what will happen, what the world will be like in December 2017. Uncertainty is a bit of a cop-out answer. But I think in our region, we do now see the withdrawing of a lot of these cardinal certainties which have underlaid the rules-based order, liberal or otherwise, that exists and that countries in the region have depended on. And that, I think, your question about alliances. Defense Secretary Mattis, I think it was very good that he chose his first ports of call to be the key Northeast Asian allies, Japan and South Korea. And I think that was largely a message of reassurance that he was giving, although there is some now reporting coming out that some of the closer statements he made in Japan suggest a bit of a tougher line emerging towards China. And I think that is grounds for optimism. And also the most recent statements attributed to Secretary of State Tillerson on the South China Sea suggest a bit of a walking back from some of those initial statements that caused alarm when people like myself followed the logic through that if access was going to be denied to China's artificial islands in the South China Sea, that the logical outcome of that would be a naval blockade. And I think now there is some clear distancing away from that, which again adds to my view that I don't think we're seeing a United States that's coming straight out from the beginning of this administration and spoiling for a fight. But on top of the uncertainty, of course, in the White House, there is the very real uncertainty about the temperament of the new president, as reflected in the storm of tweets that come out at various times of the day or night, leading to a great deal of head-scratching. But Asia has actually been rather less of a focus in the initial period, and including the inner circle, as it seems to be lining up around President Trump. They are from various backgrounds, although Peter Navarro has a clear background on China, but the National Security Advisor Flynn does not have strong Asia expertise. Even Defense Secretary Mattis has not had a senior command in the region. So that attention doesn't seem to be initially focusing on the region. But I think the geopolitics of the US-China relationship do suggest, in my mind, that that will inevitably become a focus, if not this year, then certainly at some point during Donald Trump's presidency.
And as a follow-up question, I might draw you to North Korea. How do you think the North Korean government will respond to the uncertainty that you've described following the election of President Trump?
I think the real risk of triggers of conflict are not how the United States comes out looking for a fight, but rather how North Korea and China react to the uncertainty that the United States is now partly doing intentionally, partly unintentionally. And if there's an overconfidence, then we could see a sort of stepping forward to call the bluff of the United States that then could precipitate a crisis. That could happen either in the Korean Peninsula, it could happen across the Taiwan Straits, it could happen in the South China Sea. All three flashpoints, I think, need a close watch. But the good news is that North Korea has not, for several months now, followed up its same pace of missile, long-range missile testing or nuclear testing. I think it's continuing to push the envelope, but at a lower threshold. And that's because, for the understandable reason that they are looking, I think, with one wary eye on the Donald Trump administration as not a good time to be the first crisis out of the cab rank, as the handover briefing from the Obama administration clearly hinted. I think there's also another element to it, too. You mentioned in the year ahead that there is an election pending in South Korea. South Korea is in its own political tumult. The president faces impeachment. There will likely be an election before December if that impeachment decision is reached. And in all probability, we'll see a left of center candidate elected. North Korea, of course, has a long history of looking and interfering in South Korean elections. I think for the moment, what they're doing is enjoying a ringside seat on that uncertainty and unfolding chaos in South Korea's domestic politics, and hoping that they'll get an outcome that will be more favorable to the reopening of North-South engagement. The other possibility, of course, is that they are looking at the Trump administration, too, as a potential open door from which to seek a new basis for a negotiated agreement with the United States. A long shot, I think, given the progress that North Korea has made in its missile and nuclear programs, that genie can't be put back in the box very easily, if at all. So the basis for the negotiations is now not what it was in 2008. And if we're to look back at a fair criticism of the Obama administration, is that strategic patience, it's declared policy, did very little actually to hasten the denuclearization of the peninsula. In fact, the outcome has been that North Korea has simply got on with business and is now far closer to that goal of a long-range intercontinental ballistic missile that can carry a nuclear warhead. But I wouldn't say that there is no chance of a crisis. Uncertainty, again, the word that I continue to trot out. If there is a different outcome in the election in South Korea and we end up with a right-of-center government, perfectly possible. There are routes to that. Then we could see a different dynamic unfolding in which there isn't a pro-engagement policy followed from Seoul, and we could actually see that as a spur and impetus to a further round of testing and provocations, which will then call the bluff of the United States on that key assertion of Donald Trump in one of those tweets to say that it will not happen in reference to North Korea's development of those signature capabilities.
And finally, Dr. John Edwards, how profound an impact will the election of President Trump have on the world economy? And what does that mean for the United States, for Australia, and for China?
Well, great question, Louisa. And well, I tell you what, I hope it won't be taken as a reflection on my foreign policy colleagues when I say that the characteristic of the economic realm is that the reality checks are very stringent. You can't just declare something to be so. You don't have to worry about currents of opinion. Let me give you a few examples. Mr. Trump would like to take the US growth rate up to 4%. Now, last year was 2%. GDP growth is, you can think of it as the rate of growth of the workforce plus the rate of growth of labour productivity. And in the US, the underlying rate of growth of the workforce is projected to be, over the next decade, about 0.5% per year. And in recent times, over the last 4 or 5 years, productivity growth has been running at 0.5 also. So actually, for the US to have got to 2% last year, as it did, it was doing quite well. And the only reason it got there was that it was running down unemployment. But unemployment is now below 5%. There's a limit to the extent to which you can continue to run down unemployment. So let's say you are constrained by workforce growth of 0.5, you've got to have productivity of 3.5 to get to 4, and that's 6 times higher than it is at a rate. Well, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. Trump will be doing very well indeed if he's able to sustain growth at around 2.5, which is, say, the IMF forecast. That's one example. Another one is what's happening in manufacturing in the US. Mr. Trump has said, well, we're going to impose a 40% import tariff on Chinese exports, manufactured exports to the US. But when his secretaries go to their departments, when his Treasury Secretary brings his advisors in, when his Commerce Secretary, when his US Trade Representative, when they bring their advisors in, what they'll be told is, look, Mr. Secretary or Madam Secretary, you're no doubt aware that actually in the US, manufacturing output today is 1/3 higher than it was when China joined the World Trade Organization in 2000. It's 1/3 higher. And it's true that manufacturing as a share of GDP has gone down in the US, but not by much. It's gone down here much further. It's gone down worldwide much further than in the US. It went from 14% in the year 2000 to 12% today. Hardly budged. So what's happened, of course, in the US is that it's moved up. It's got out of high labour-intensive stuff, but it's still very big in manufacturing, and it's still very big up there where they're using robots and other, you know, capital-intensive production processes. Now, the US is not going to go back. The US is not going to start making clothes and shoes. It's not going to make many television sets or washing machines unless robots do it. So what the advisors are going to tell the US Trade Representative when this issue of 40% tariff on Chinese imports comes up is, well, you can do it, but you know who will be affected. It's the Trump constituents in Michigan and Pennsylvania and Ohio who are getting all their stuff from Walmart and Home Depot who are going to have to pay another 40% for it. Is that sensible? For no gain for the US in employment. That's the kind of, I think, the kind of reality check that they're going to encounter. Or they may say in the Treasury Department, Mr. Trump had promised on day one to declare China a currency manipulator because taking the view that yuan or renminbi was cheap against the US dollar. But what they'll point out to the new cabinet officials is that over the last year, China's foreign reserves have gone down from $4 trillion to $3 trillion, and that trillion US dollars was basically spent buying renminbi to keep it up, in a free market. Yuan would be very much lower than it is now because of the export of capital by private businesses in China. So there are limits to what you can actually do in the economy. You can't just declare things to be so, and they're going to encounter the same problem, I think, in the budget. The Trump administration committed to tax cuts and so forth, not to spending cuts, tax cuts. But the US Federal Reserve is pushing up interest rates. You've got health spending anyway running far faster than the rate of growth of nominal GDP. So without doing anything at all, the US budget deficit, according to the Congressional Budget Office, will double as a share of GDP from 2% to 4% in the first term of the Trump administration. That's without doing anything. And the House Republicans don't like it. Senate Republicans don't like it. There's going to be a great deal of difficulty, I think, in a vast unfunded program of tax cuts. And again, I think he'll have trouble there. So my view, Louisa, is that the cabinet officials will adjust, the advisors will adjust, the aides will adjust. The big question in my mind is, will President Trump adjust? Will he adjust? How does he cope with meeting reality, the unavoidable reality of the US economy?
In 2017, what prospects do you think there are for a financial crisis in China?
Well, it's always a risk. It's a risk in China because there's a very large amount of debt that is not being serviced. The debt, very large amounts of debt that are of money that's been lent to state-owned enterprises, which they can only meet the interest and repayments on it by borrowing more. So this is a problem. It's a real problem. And if the Chinese authorities allowed it to get out of control, we would have a global financial crisis far worse than anything that President Trump is likely to produce, at least over the next year. But I rather think that the likelihood of this occurring is very slight. And the reason is this, that although there is considerable bad debt in China, it's basically Chinese state-owned enterprises borrowing from Chinese state-owned banks, and they're all borrowing in yuan. There's no external lenders involved. So it's a kind of a, you might think of it as a kind of a book transaction. On the numbers I've seen by rating agencies, China's authorities can basically retire almost all of the unserviceable debt at the cost of around about 20% of GDP, which would take their central government debt from around about 40% of GDP to about 60%, compared, say, to the US where it's 80%, or China where it's, you know, well over 200%. So it's well within China's gift to actually deal with this problem, and sooner or later I think they probably will.
I'm going to turn now to the audience for some questions. I'll ask you to wait for the microphone. We have Andrea on one side and Emma on the other. So please wait for the microphone. Tell us your name and your affiliation if you have one, and please keep your question relatively short. I saw this gentleman in the front first.
Eric, just a private citizen. Interested in your thoughts on Trump and the United Nations. He said a lot during the campaign. I don't think he said anything since he's come into office. What was ahead for the UN in 2017?
We'd like to address that. Aaron, do you want to have a...
Yeah, sure. So one of Trump's foreign policy advisors during the transition, it's not clear how much influence he has now in the White House, was John Bolton, who was President Bush's ambassador to the United Nations, and who famously said that you could knock 10 floors off the top of the UN Secretariat and no one would know the difference. And so, you know, there's a question as to how much influence Bolton will have in the administration. As I said earlier, this has been the slowest presidential transition in modern times, in anyone's memory. And the reason for that is because the Trump team was mostly unprepared to take office. What little preparation they had done under New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was quickly thrown out the window because Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, has a personal vendetta against Governor Christie. Governor Christie, when he was U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of New Jersey, jailed Kushner's father, who I believe is still in jail. And so Christie and his team were tossed out, and all their plans were tossed out. And so we don't actually know who will fill key positions in the administration. We're still waiting to learn who the Deputy Secretary of State will be. But one rumor early on was that it would be John Bolton. And if John Bolton were to be Deputy Secretary of State, particularly guiding a Secretary of State like Rex Tillerson, who doesn't have as much experience, especially in these multilateral issues, I think we could expect to see a very negative attitude toward the United Nations. We know that there is some talk within the Trump White House of withdrawing all U.S. funding for the United Nations. That would be about 20% of its budget. And so there's reason to be pretty concerned about the U.S. relationship with the UN. You know, Republicans in Congress would mostly support that. There are some Republicans who, while they have issues with the way that the UN is run and administered, would not support withdrawing all funding. And they may act as a check on that. It's worth keeping in mind that though Republicans do control the Senate, there are enough Republican senators in the Republican caucus who are anti-Trump that Trump in some ways doesn't have a majority in the Senate. Republicans do, but Trump does not. And so, you know, if Marco Rubio and John McCain and Jeff Flake were to oppose withdrawing all funding from the United Nations, that would, you know, potentially complicate any attempt to do so. But that would also be very politically difficult for them. They would have to go back to their districts, to their states, and explain to conservatives in a Republican primary why they didn't take the opportunity to withdraw funding for the UN when they had the chance. So we'll have to wait and see who fills these key roles, what Congress does, and how it plays out. But there's reason for concern.
Let's take a brief stab at that. I think, the conventional wisdom is that the Trump administration is not going to follow a multilateral track, anything like to the degree of its predecessor. It's going to fall back on the traditional relationships on a bilateral axis. To the extent that it plays multilaterally, it's probably more likely to be ad hoc rather than through the Uber multilateral framework of the United Nations. But then I think there's likely to be a learning curve as all ideologically saturated administrations start out with a biased view towards the United Nations, but without it, you have to invent something rather like it. So I think its uses will inevitably creep in. We also have a change of leadership in the United Nations too, which I think is probably helpful. Mr. Gutierrez seems to have got off to a good start, so he may be able to capitalize on that to also from the United Nations pulling on the rope side of the relationship to draw the United States in. And the U.S. representative seems to have got off to a fairly activist start in a way that maybe people did not predict by giving out some rather hardline messages towards Russia as her initial messages. So it I don't think it's going to be a wholesale withdrawal from U.S. From United Nations on the U.S. part.
I can see a hand over here. And we're just in the interest of time, I'm going to take a few questions and then let the panel answer the ones that that they'd like to answer so that we can get as many of the questions covered as possible. I'll start with this gentleman over here.
Thank you, and thanks for the presentation. Daniel Upton, no affiliation. My question is, there's been some reports that China could, as a test to the Trump administration, declare an air defence identification zone over the South China Sea region. If that were to go ahead, what would that mean for Australia, given the current nature of the relationship that we seem to have?
Thank you. Nick McClellan from Highlands Business Magazine. I wonder if you could comment about the problem for the Turnbull government about using political capital if the Trump administration does take bold steps, for example, on nuclear issues, on climate change, which no one has mentioned, on foreign aid and so on. Our neighbours in the region, for example, Fiji is currently president of the UN General Assembly, is chairing the next COP, has much more aid from China than Australia now. So regionally, the Turnbull government's got to decide whether it cozies up to an erratic Trump policy or works with countries in the neighbourhood. For example, the negotiations on a nuclear weapons ban treaty, which begin next month. Every country in the Asia-Pacific region, except Australia and Japan, voted yes at the UN General Assembly. For the negotiations to proceed. So there's a number of tripwires coming that the big players are actually going to cause problems for the government. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
Thank you. And I've got a hand up the back as the third question, please.
David Simpson, no affiliation. What I wanted to really know is, what do you think the probabilities are for European integrity over the coming 2017, particularly with reference to Le Pen and France? And what that might spell for Australia and the rest of the world.
Thanks. Three great questions. Two of them looking at what the developments in international affairs mean for Australia in 2017, how the Turnbull government should respond, and a third looking at the probabilities for European integrity. I might turn to you, Ewan, Dr. Ewan Graham, on EU issues to start.
Sure. I'll also have a go at the air defence identification zone question. Short answer, I think, yes, if there's a Le Pen victory in France, then it's a potentially existential blow to the future of the UN. And I think there's no doubt that it's being seen in that dramatic light in European capitals. I think the EU is already very much on the back foot in how to deal with Russia, how to deal with a migration crisis on its southern periphery. And, of course, the wild card of the UK withdrawing from the EU has also taken up a lot of the discretionary slack of what diplomatic energy the EU has left to deal with that. France is a core member country. It matters far more if France is to take an antipathetic policy towards the EU than the UK. The EU can get by if the UK pulls out. And I think there's a sort of common recognition that it was always a one foot in, one foot out type relationship. France has had both feet in. And I think the blow that would be dealt to not just foreign policy, but of course the future of the euro, we could see a more dramatic unwinding. And if we're going to single out personalities that really count in this, Angela Merkel faces her own election. If there's a weakening of support for a liberal pro EU policy in Germany, as there could be, then that could be a double blow. And of course, EU at its core is really a Franco-German partnership with a constellation around it. On the ADIZ question and China and the South China Sea, I've always tended to take a rather skeptical view of the ADIZ, because the ADIZ, for those who are not familiar, it's an air defense identification zone. It's not a capability, it's a declaration of what essentially is a rather technical requirement that goes back to the Cold War of being able to identify civilian aircraft and differentiate them from approaching military aircraft. But it's acquired a new, more geopolitical significance since China's declaration of an ADIZ in the East China Sea. What we've seen happen in the South China Sea is China's been able to develop these artificial islands and is progressively rolling out infrastructure on those islands. One thing I think is important to flag is that China is not sitting on its hands at the moment. Even though there is no sense of incipient crisis, a lot of that infrastructure is continuously being filled in. And that includes the radars, the runways, the hardened shelters that would support a forward Air Force presence. Fully developed, that would give China a much greater reach and ability to send its air power out to the southern reaches of the South China Sea. But I think it's still some way off from being able to enforce an ADIZ. And the lesson of 2013 in the East China Sea is don't declare it if you don't have the capability to do it, because then it makes China look weak. So I think they will actually be rather cautious about doing that. But I suspect will be a more kind of progressive lily pad type approach, where you'll get exercises with closures of its sea and airspace. The areas will become progressively larger, and reaction will be tested of regional countries as well as the United States. That would be the lower risk approach, and I think is the one that China will use.
And more broadly, Dr. John Edwards, if I can go to you to ask, what do you think the Turnbull government will do in response to global developments in 2017?
Well, I do think that the Trump administration has given the Australian government a gift. It's withdrawn from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade agreement involving 12 nations, essentially sponsored by the US, and essentially written to suit the structure of the US economy, very strong on intellectual property rights, very strong on investor state protections, and so forth. I don't think it's something we're going to miss, even on the most, say it wouldn't have been a useful agreement to have, but I don't think it's going to be one that we'll miss, because even on the most optimistic scenario, the increase in our GDP as a result of that agreement in 15 years' time might be, say, 1%, and we would, in the ordinary course of things, expect our GDP to be, at that time, to be 40% higher than it is now. So the additional one, so you hardly notice it. I don't think we're going to miss the TPP, but it does give us a great opportunity, which I think we should seize. That is, we've been talking for quite a while about a free trade area of the Asia-Pacific. It was sponsored first by the US. in both the Bush and Bush Jr. and Clinton administrations. It's now officially, at least, sponsored by China, but in the case of neither China nor the US, has there been actual moves to create it, to create a schedule, a framework, a procedure where this agreement might be brought about. And this agreement would basically be APEC-wide in conception. It would be far and away the biggest trade agreement in the world, and one that would considerably add to regional GDP because trade barriers within the region are quite high. Well, I think just as we did with APEC so many years ago, we have an opportunity, Australia has an opportunity, a country which has the trade infrastructure, the bureaucratic means to carry the proposal, that has the advantage of being reasonably well respected but not feared within the region as the major powers are. I think we have the opportunity to seize this and push it. We tried once in the our first Rudd government, but it didn't do it well. I think the US has basically, by vacating that space, by releasing us from the TPP, has given this great opportunity for Australia to pursue a far bigger agreement that, although the US wouldn't participate in it for the next few years, given its stance, it would certainly be drawn into it later on. So that's what I think. We should be grabbing this great opportunity.
If I could just come in briefly on, in defense of the TPP, the advantage of the TPP was not, and I will leave the economic analysis to Dr. Edwards, the advantage of the TPP was not what it would have done for individual countries' GDPs, which would have been, by on the account of most analysts who looked at it carefully, pretty modest. It would have been the principles that it laid down for future free trade agreements in this region. So things like forcing Southeast Asian countries that are heavily reliant on a state-owned sector to privatize those companies in a way that is very difficult for them to do politically. For the Vietnamese Communist Party to do this, to privatize some of their state-owned banks, particularly the ones that gave a lot of bad loans out over the last 10 years, would be extremely difficult politically, but they were prepared to do it if it granted them access to the U.S. and Japanese markets as part of TPP. There was other disciplines on technology that said if you're a technology company, you don't have to have servers in every country that you operate in so that security services in those countries can access the personal data of people who use those services in that country. You can have servers anywhere. They can be in California or they can be in Broome. It doesn't really matter. You can have it anywhere. Data should be mobile. And so those principles, if the TPP goes away, go away with it. And they're likely to develop in a much more balkanized sort of way that limits the ability of companies in the future to innovate in a way that would be helpful in this region. And so I think the best course, I think Dr. Edwards is absolutely right in that there is an opportunity here for Australia to really take a leadership role in the region, as it did with APEC in the late 80s. I would dispute the characterization of Rudd's Asia-Pacific community as a particularly a positive example. But there is an opportunity for Australia to lead in the region on free trade. But the model for that should be TPP-1. It should be leave the United States out for now and try to do an 11-nation agreement. The difficulty will be convincing Japan, because Japan wasn't in it for those principles. Japan was in it for access to the U.S. market. And there was basically a bilateral trade deal done between Japan and the United States in order to get TPP done. And so convincing Japan that this is important to the liberal international order will be an uphill climb, but it's one that the government should try.
And I might have a stab at the question that related to climate change in particular. I think, let me start by saying that we saw some real progress and some really disappointing things in 2016 in the climate space. We saw a continued drop in energy prices, renewable energy prices. In the States, renewable energy is becoming more competitive as compared to fossil fuels. We've seen really significant advances in storage technology, which is very important because it enables renewable energy to replace fossil fuels as baseload power. We saw the Paris Climate Agreement signed in New York and ratified by both the US and China and several other countries as well. And we started to see a reduction in emissions in the US, which was partly to do with natural gas, partly to do with consumer behaviour and consumer preferences, and partly to do, of course, with the falling cost of renewable energies. But at the same time, we saw record temperatures in a lot of countries around the world. We got conclusive proof that oceans are warming. We saw here at home droughts and floods. And in the Arctic, we saw a record low of wintertime ice. But, of course, we also saw the election of President Trump, which throws some real uncertainty on the US's continued leadership in, along with China, in the climate space. And as Aaron Connolly mentioned before, President Trump has surrounded himself with fossil fuel advocates like Rex Tillerson, who's had a long career at ExxonMobil. And there's little evidence that President Trump is going to take the issue of climate change as seriously as his predecessor. People will be aware of his inflammatory tweet that climate change was a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese, and we haven't realistically seen an improvement on that, although he has said that he will keep an open mind on the climate change issue. I think that there is some hope globally for 2017. Obviously, we've got the power of consumers, and we're starting to see that in several countries around the world. Prices will continue to fall, and we will continue to see leadership from China. China's obviously facing some very serious environmental concerns, but they're at the same time that they have aggressive targets for renewable energy. They have aggressive targets for emission reductions, and we will continue to see, I think, Chinese leadership on that issue. What does that mean for the Prime Minister here? Well, historically, we haven't seen prime ministers justify continued action on climate change on the basis of what the US or China is doing. Climate change action, where it has been undertaken by the Australian government, has generally been driven by consumer sentiment, by the media, and by feeling that this is what the Australian population wants. So I think that although the election of President Trump may be bad news for climate globally, I don't think it has a significant impact on what Prime Minister Turnbull will do here. We're coming up towards the end of today's session, so I'm going to close by asking the panellists to make one prediction each on the year ahead, and I'll start with you, Aaron Connolly.
I think, to borrow from Ewan's comments earlier, we're entering an incredibly uncertain period, and it's a bit of a cop-out for analysts like us to cite that, but we should expect more things that we wouldn't normally expect. I've given you a couple of examples. One, I think, is going to be this fight between institutions and the Trump White House. The way that plays out is going to be determinative of U.S. policy. We've never seen anything like this before. Generally, civil servants in the United States are fairly nonpartisan. They recognize the legitimacy of one party's win, and they follow that party's policy, and they execute it faithfully. The difference here is not about partisanship. It's not as though the civil service is just packed with Democrats and they can't stand Trump. It's because President Trump's agenda is fundamentally illiberal. And these institutions are not set up to execute that, because presidents of both parties, going back to Andrew Jackson, have followed fundamentally liberal policies. They might disagree about where to draw the line on equality and liberty, but it was a disagreement about where to draw the line. Now the disagreement is about whether or not to stand up for liberty. That is, I think, going to be dispositive for the next year and probably for the next 4 years.
Dr. Ewan Graham.
Maybe I'll take the excuse of the prediction to get back and address the gentleman's question about what it means for Australia, because it's where we are after all. But in the security and defence field, and rather like economics, it's not a fantasy space. There are limits on what can be done. Australia is a middle power. It has to marshal its resources smartly and intelligently, and pick its fights as selectively as possible. One result of the uncertainty that we've already seen, would we have expected of the two key alliances often referred to as the Southern Anchor and the Northern Anchor in the Western Pacific, that Japan would actually come out with a relatively benign view of the Trump administration, with bilateral relations eased through Secretary Mattis's visit. Mr. Abe is due to go to Washington, D.C. next week. Let's see what he gets out of the commander-in-chief. That'll be a key test. But so far, it seems as though that relationship, despite the predictions of meltdown in US-Japan relations, is actually going in such a positive way that I even wonder whether the contrast will be reflected negatively on Australia, taking a much more cautious view towards defence cooperation with the United States. And I think the key test of that will be the South China Sea, which will come up at some point. I think it's already been flagged that US expectations will be there of doing more than they did under the Obama administration, where it was a fairly diluted approach to the Freedom of Navigation program. Four missions were done. When it comes to expectations, it's a short list. Australia will be very close to the top of it. Japan will traditionally have been seen as rather down it. I think now we might see Japan being seen as the loyal ally in the Asia, in Western Pacific, and Australia increasingly, although history, it's often said that Australia has been toe-to-toe with the United States in every conflict since World War I. But I think increasingly the tension in Australia's foreign policy between wanting to maintain its security and eat its economic cake with the China relationship is going to come home to roost. And I think we're going to see that play out in increased tensions between Canberra and Washington.
Dr. John Edwards, a prediction from you?
Well, in the economic realm, I think it's going to be a really tumultuous year. We're going to have very, very exciting stories. We're going to have any number of confected crises. I think by mid-year, we will have seen that the Federal Reserve will have continued to raise interest rates in the US. We'll probably see growth, you know, around 2, maybe 2.5. We will have seen a trade negotiation between the US and Mexico on one hand and between the US and China on the other, which by September, October, November, I think people are beginning to lose interest. And I think we'll get to the end of this really tumultuous year, Louisa, and I think at the end of it, nothing much will have changed.
That's a good note to end on. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us and for asking such thoughtful questions. Let me thank the panel, and we hope to see you next time.